Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Raul Romaguera, and I am the Deputy Director for the Division of STD Prevention at CDC. And this is the second plenary of the conference. And the title of this plenary is How to Prevent STDs Without Doing STD Prevention, Policies to Address Poverty and Other Social Determinants of Health. And our first speaker this afternoon is Dr. Sheldon Dassinger. Dr. Dassinger is the president of the Russell Sage Foundation, and he's going to be talking about poverty, public policy, and public health. The Russell Sage Foundation supports social science research for the improvement of social and living conditions in the United States. He's also the Dr. Dassinger is also the Henry Meyer Distinguished University Professor of Public Policy Emeritus at the Gerald Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. He was also the director of the National Poverty Center at the same University of Michigan. His research focuses on social welfare policies and on the effects of economic, demographic, and public policy changes on trends in poverty and inequality. Among his publications, he is the co-author of America Unequal and co-editor of Legacies of the War on Poverty. Please welcome Dr. Dassinger.
Thank you. When I got an email about the conference and I saw it was an STD conference, I said, are you sure you have the right person? This isn't my area. But I think I know why, and I'll read two sentences from The New Yorker in an article in April of this year called Life Expectancy Inequality Grows in America. It says, the richest 1% of American men live 14.6 years longer on average than the poorest 1%. For women, the average difference is just over 10 years. So I think that's the context. While I'm not going to be speaking about public health policies per se, I am going to be speaking about policies that would reduce poverty and inequality, and I think by implication reduce a lot of health disparities. The simple soundbite for my talk is that the conventional wisdom is wrong. I'll show you how we got to the conventional wisdom. But the conventional wisdom is that government programs don't work. We should get government out of the way, and we should grow the economy, and growing the economy is the way to reduce poverty and inequality. I want to argue that that may have been true from 1945 to 1965, but it certainly hasn't been true since the early 1970s. Instead, the reverse is true. For 40 years, the economy has failed the poor. And in recent years, it's even failed the middle class, and that we actually need more government programs because the ones we have work, but what they do is in part masked because they're having to work harder to offset the negative effects of the economy. And for a statistical reason, many of the programs that work aren't counted in the official poverty measure for strange historical reasons, so that we don't typically get the right perspective on what government programs can do. So here's a brief outline. I'll do a very brief history of what the War on Poverty had in mind, then expand on what I just told you about, it's the failure of the economy, talk about how we got to the conventional wisdom, and end with some suggestions for policy changes that would make a difference. Although I am trained as an economist and we're trained to be dismal, so I won't offer great hope for results. Very briefly, and the reason this slide is here, anybody interested in poverty should actually read Chapter 2 from Lyndon Johnson's Economic Report of the President, which came out in January 64, less than 2 months after President Kennedy had been assassinated. For anybody who works in government today, the fact that you can get anything out in 2 months is remarkable, And this was in the days before track change mode and computers passing things back and forth. It's a remarkable document, and indeed it set out a broad strategy, one of which was the improvement of the nation's health. And obviously Medicare and Medicaid are two lasting achievements of the war on poverty. Now, they don't affect poverty or inequality as we typically measure it. The perspective at the time was that economic growth was necessary. Again, I don't want to interpret my introductory remarks as saying economic growth isn't important. It's a lot easier to fight poverty and inequality in 2015 when the economy is growing and jobs are being created than it was in 2008 when jobs were disappearing and firms were collapsing. So the important thing there is economic growth is necessary, but on its own, it's not sufficient. And you can read that in the 1964 document. Something that's certainly not conventional wisdom today, but at the time, the planners believed, because of discrimination, because of where people lived, where they were born, their parents' inability to provide them with resources, that poverty was not primarily the fault of individuals, in part because of unequal opportunities in education and the labor market. What's remarkable, if you do go back and read the historical documents, you can think you're reading something out of today's articles and newspaper. The focus was reducing poverty by providing people higher income, primarily through earnings, but also through government programs. The post-war on poverty decade, if you go back and look, was a period of both rapid economic growth, declining poverty, and optimism that government could make a difference. The optimism came to an end as the war in Vietnam escalated, and indeed, President Johnson hardly gets much attention for anything other than the Vietnam fiasco. But if one actually looks, and in the book that Raul mentioned, Legacies of the War on Poverty, my colleague Martha Bailey, who's an economic historian, points out a lot of recent research that shows that the Johnson administration was quite explicit in linking civil rights and anti-discrimination policy to the social programs it put into place. So we had this golden age in which it really was the case that a light rising tide lifted all boats. There was rapid economic growth, rapid wage growth for all workers, increased employer-provided health insurance and pension. The minimum wage rose relative to inflation. There was rapidly falling poverty and slowly falling inequality. If you want to know what happens since 1973, the simple statement would be just multiply all this by minus one. We've been in a gilded age of rising inequality now for going on 40 years. As I'll show you, even though people followed the good news, poverty has been falling since the worst recession since the 30s, but poverty is still not back to the 1973 level, nor are the earnings of workers, even, I'll show you, men who work full-time, full year. And this is the chart that I think says it all. When people say a rising tide lift all boats, you can just look at the top blue line. The top line is men. The bottom line is women. When people say rising tide lifts all boats, if you look from 1960 to 1973, you just see a line going up. And that was sort of the expectation that earnings, as the economy grows, earnings grows. And yet, 40 years later, and this is true even with the very good numbers that came out earlier this month from the census, median earnings of full-time year-round workers in 2015 have still not reached the level of 1973. The good news is we're back to 1999, but again, it's a little unusual that we would be having a parade and partying like it's 1999 in 2016. That's not what I think people think of about the economy. The reason I focus on full-time year-round men is because the critique of government programs, unemployment insurance and food stamp, create a hammock, and people are poor because they don't work. There may be, you know, you can always find some people like that. The research doesn't say anything like that. And here, these data are for people who don't get UI. They don't get food stamps, the median full-time male worker. So I think that critique is overblown. I'm going to skip through. I'll just say something about inequality. This is probably a simple chart to realize. This is CEO to work to the average worker compensation from the Economic Policy Institute, which updates this. Again, the good news is things aren't as bad as they were. CEOs, and by the way, these CEOs averaged $15 million last year, earn 276 times what the typical worker earns, and you can see these numbers were 20, 30, and 60 previously. So that's a little bit about inequality. Again, just to, these are pictures. My slides are available. People can get them. But if you just look at the left, you see tall bars all about the same. That's what we mean when we say a rising tide lifts all boats. That's what the world was like for American families from the end of World War II to the mid-1970s. All the bars are high. If you look to the right, what do we mean by rising inequality? You get this nice step ladder. The people at the bottom did worse than the people at the 40th, did worse than the people at the 60th, did worse than the people at the 95th. But note, all of them are lower than they were previously. So this, when people say it's government programs that are distorting these things, again, government programs aren't distorting the gains for the top 5%, but the top 5%, even though they grew dramatically relative to the bottom, didn't do as well as they did in the post-war period. I know my time is short, but I thought I had to say something about inequality other than the quote from the New Yorker, and these are the data that essentially show for men and women the growing gaps in life expectancy between the first quintile and the top quintile, and you can see not much gain, and in fact, this is life expectancy at age 50, a slight loss, particularly for women, and gains for those at the top. And the data I quoted, which I guess is from a JAMA paper last year, are from very large data sets that actually allow Raj Chetty and his colleagues to look at the top 1%. The implications of this, just very quickly, when people say there's too much money going to Social Security, there's too much money going to Social Security for people at very high incomes who really don't need it, and something like raising the retirement age across the board is the exact wrong way to do it, because lots of low-income people then would die before getting Social Security. So that's not my talk today, but that's a bit of a footnote. The poverty rates, again, the good news is that 2015, that was just released, the number, the top blue line, which is for all person, is around 13.5%. That's a lot better than it was in 2012, but again, we're not anywhere near where we were in 1990. Actually, I think, yeah, I should have 1999 on here. The last little dip was 1999, but we're still above 1999 and still above 1973. So why isn't the story I've quickly told you the one you would hear if you went to congressional hearings or read most media. And it's because when the economy began to turn against the poor, the discourse turned against the poor and blamed the poor and not the economy for their problems. So instead of saying the poor lack equal opportunity to good schools and employment, we said the poor are unwilling to work hard in school and achieve. They're unwilling to work hard and take any available job and pull themselves up by their bootstraps. They don't take advantage of available opportunities. It's not the lack of opportunities. The opportunities are there. They don't seize them. Government programs exacerbate the problem, and the famous quote from President Reagan, you can read this quote every year on the Heritage Foundation website when the numbers come out and the census reports there's high poverty. It features in a lot of political discourse, and it's arguing that somehow poverty won the war because instead of helping the poor, government programs ruptured the bonds holding poor families together. The evidence does not show that, but that's clearly a conventional wisdom. So what is it about the economy? I'll give you a quick 1 minute. Skill bias, technological changes, globalization, declining unionization, changes in employer practices, erosion of the inflation-adjusted minimum wage, declining progressivity of the federal income tax, and the explosion of executive pay have all contributed to a growing gap between workers, particularly those at the bottom, and those at top. Some very brief evidence that safety net programs work, and these I picked the health impacts that would be of interest to this group. This is research in which the authors were able to gather data on when food stamps became available in counties. It's not like it came in all at once. It was gradually rolled in. Someone, in fact, recently has looked at data and knows one child was age 5 when food stamps came in. Another child in the family wasn't born when food stamps came in, and 30 years later, there are measurable health outcome differences between the children. And for people interesting, the first author on a lot of this is Hillary Hoynes, who's at the University of California, Berkeley, and the papers are usually on the National Bureau of Economic Research website. So you can see that these are estimates of what happened when the food stamp program came into place based on longitudinal data as children were have been followed throughout their life in the panel study of income dynamics. A 6 percentage point drop in stunted growth, a 5 percentage point decrease in heart disease, 16 percentage point difference in obesity, and an 18 percentage point increase in high school completion. So where are we? As I said, I'll get dismal. The economy, the good news is the economy is back to where it was about 7 years after the end of the Great Recession. The Great Recession ended officially in June 2009. Yet the unemployment rate, while falling, it's below 5%, we still haven't reached the 4% that we had in the late 1990s, or more important, the labor force participation rate we had in 2007. There's recent evidence from this year, 1 year alone, which is great news, that there was some real wage growth for less educated workers, but the losses over the last 30 to 40 years are so great it would take many years like this one. income and wealth inequalities are very high and are unlikely to change without policy interventions. Many states, and I think in this group probably the best example would be, I think it's 19 states that refused to take billions of dollars and accept the Medicaid expansion, which would have increased employment in the health sector and reduced uninsurance in those states. And the reason they say they didn't do it is because they didn't believe the money was free, that somehow there would be a bait and switch. That strikes me as a reason why you might have taken the money and said, okay, we're going to only take the money as long as the federal government pays for it. But that didn't happen. So I'll give you some modest policy recommendations, ones that I think would continue the kind of safety net expansion we've had that's been demonstrated to work. The most important goes back to the original view of the war on poverty. President Johnson was in favor of a hand up and not a hand out, and a lot of attention was focused on employment and training and reducing discrimination and Head Start, Pell Grants, all of the current mechanisms that we have in place that support education from the federal government, from preschool, Title I through college, all came about in the few years after the war on poverty was launched. But the way the economy works now is different. The war on poverty planners thought all we have to do is get people ready for the labor force and the economy will absorb them. Well, we know in that today's labor market, particularly one of labor-saving technological change, think of what the world will be like. Let's assume 20 years from now, they've gotten all the bugs out of the driverless cars. There will be fewer deaths and accidents, and that clearly is a public health gain. There will be millions fewer taxi drivers and truck drivers. So labor-saving technological change is here to stay. It's got nothing to do, that has nothing to do with China, that has to do with labor-saving technological change. We're in that kind of a situation for many workers today who came of age in an era when you could graduate high school and go to work at an auto plant and have good wages and a stable middle-class lifestyle. So one of the things I think that's really important in the current world is, and we got rid of these in, not surprisingly, the early 80s when the Reagan administration eliminated what was called CETA, the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act. And so I think it's important to establish a subsidized jobs program for those willing to work at the minimum wage who can't find an employer who will hire them. Examples being the long-term unemployment, welfare recipients, recently released people with felony records. What's interesting is that only by offering these jobs can we get at the two viewpoints that are different. And in fact, I was a member of American Enterprise Institute, Brookings Working Group, that had conservatives and progressives. And we actually, in the end, all agreed that you could expect more from people who were getting safety net benefits if you provided work opportunities. In the current system, we observe people who are unemployed getting food stamps. And I say, I bet most of them want to work and would take a job. The problem is employers don't want to hire them, either because of labor-saving technological change or they're looking for different kinds of workers. Certainly in Ann Arbor, where I used to be a barista, I think you had to speak several languages because that was always good customer service if you could speak to students from various countries in their own language. That's certainly not required to be a barista. The people on the other side said, oh, those are people on unemployment, on food stamps or unemployment. They don't want to work. We should take away their benefits. And so they actually, on this group, agreed, okay, we'll offer them the job, and then if they don't take it, we'll take away their benefits. But we don't know because we haven't done the experiment. So what we have is essentially political rhetoric or one side or the other when here's a way to actually demonstrate this. It turns out during the recession, there was something called the TANF Emergency Fund and the stimulus, which gave states $5 billion, small amount of money in the large scheme of things, and they did subsidize workers either in the private sector or nonprofits, or sometimes in the public sector, and it seems to be have been successful, and states with both Republican and Democratic governors liked it. And so, again, that was part of the reason why this bipartisan group or nonpartisan group could agree on the importance of assuring job availability in an economy in which high-skilled labor has been in greater demand and less-skilled labor has been in falling demand. Very quickly, the other things, raising minimum wage, maintaining full employment, expanding the earned income tax credit for childless workers is something that both Speaker Ryan and President Obama have proposed. It hasn't gone anywhere because one side wants to pay for it by cutting social spending and one side wants to pay for it by raising taxes, and there's no ability to compromise in Congress. Expanding child care subsidies and access to pre-K, and the most important is to maintain food stamps as a federal program without a work test, because this is the 20th anniversary of the 1996 welfare reform, and what we learned from that was that the policies for the working poor that were expanded as part of that were successful in reducing caseloads and raising employment and earnings and supplementing those earnings, so that it's actually never been better to be a minimum wage worker with kids because of a lot of the expanded benefits that came in the welfare reform. On the other hand, it's much worse if you aren't working, either because you don't have the skills or you have health or mental health problems or learning disabilities or all sorts of things that people have that keep them from working, because now if you're not working, you don't get cash assistance and you don't get access to this work-based safety net. How would I pay for it? I would raise taxes on the rich to pay for policies, because I think, as I've shown, that's where the money went. Responses to critics. I've obviously given you one side of the story, but I've tried to at least help you see what the other side says. And this is just to sum up, it's the labor market changes and public policy changes, not a failure to take available jobs, are the reasons for our economic troubles. The safety net programs actually work. I've shown you some data in that. They don't have large distortions on work and family choices. For every person who gets UI and takes a vacation instead of looking for work, there are probably 50 others who are looking hard for work and dreading when that unemployment insurance runs off, and that modest tax increases can reduce poverty and inequality without disrupting the market economy. Thanks.